Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director at WKAR. What a week! Even as we tape this show on Friday night, there are new developments from Michigan State University, as well as the state capitol, following a marathon lame duck legislative session. So let's start with MSU. On Friday night, Governor Rick Snyder appointed hospital executive Nancy Schlichting to the Michigan State University Board of Trustees. She will replace George Perlis, who resigned in late November. Schlichting is a former CEO of the Henry Ford Health System. She is credited with turning the company's finances around. The Detroit News also reports that she interviewed with Donald Trump's transition team for the Secretary of Veteran Affairs post. That news came hours after a new report made public by the independent special counsel investigating Michigan State University and its handling of the Larry Nassar sexual abuse case. As WKAR's Abigail Sinsky reports, MSU is accused of being intentionally uncooperative.
The report charges that MSU is perpetuating a culture of indifference towards sexual assault by refusing to cooperate fully with investigators. Special Counsel William Forsyth says we may never know what happened as long as the school continues to invoke attorney-client privilege.
Things are more important than money and finances. And in this case, the survivors and the public, I think, deserve to know what happened here. But it's pretty clear they're not going to waive the privilege.
The report also alleges the school employed protectionist tactics to insulate and protect the school from any future lawsuits. The tactics included dumping thousands of unrelated documents for investigators to go through and hiring a legal team to represent the university when witnesses were interviewed. The school issued a statement emphasizing no additional criminal charges had been brought. I'm Abigail Sensky in Lansing.
So far, the investigation has produced criminal cases against former MSU gymnastics coach Kathy Klagas, former dean William Strample, and former university president Luana K. Simon. In May, MSU reached a $500 million settlement with 332 women and girls who said they were assaulted by Nassar. Hundreds of women and minors, most of them gymnasts, accused Nassar of sexually assaulting them when they sought treatment when he served as a doctor for MSU and USA Gymnastics. He is now serving time in a federal prison in Florida after pleading guilty to possessing child pornography. Thank you for listening to Current State from WKAR. Also this weekend, Governor Rick Snyder has started to make decisions on the 408 bills passed by the legislature in the lame duck session this month. On Friday, Governor Snyder vetoed a bill to let an independent auditor general have access to confidential information stored in state departments and agencies. He also vetoed a first-time buyer savings program in Michigan. Please keep checking WKAR.org throughout the weekend for the bills that the governor has approved or vetoed. As you know, Michigan is the 10th state in the U.S. to legalize recreational marijuana use, and investors are smelling the profit potential in pot. Michigan also shares a border with Canada, where pot was legalized in October. As Quinn Kleinfelter of our Detroit NPR member station WDET reports, anyone in the cannabis industry trying to cross the border could see their right to enter the U.S. go up in smoke.
What is your citizenship?
My citizenship.
The U.S. Transportation Department says more than a quarter of all the trade between the U.S. and Canada crosses here through the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel and the nearby Ambassador Bridge. But Customs Officer Agron Martini says some travelers may not make it through if there's even a whiff that their trip involves marijuana.
Anytime somebody plans on entering the United States to involve themselves in the distribution, proliferation, possession of any form of marijuana, that could lead to them being found inadmissible.
Even traveling just to discuss doing business with the U.S. pot industry can be considered illegal drug trafficking. About a month ago, Canadian cannabis consultant Rod Elliott says he and roughly two dozen others were detained before they could board a flight to a marijuana business conference in Las Vegas.
We were able to get through the next morning. There were people who were traveling to that conference who told the border agents that they were investors in the U.S. cannabis industry, and those people were given a lifetime ban.
So Elliot says he and some of his colleagues will simply avoid taking business trips to the U.S.
I have been told by people in the industry that I will not travel to the United States if there is even the mere possibility that I will face a lifetime ban because I work in the legal Canadian cannabis industry.
Michigan's budding cannabis market next door to Canada is drawing significant investment interest, but Detroit medical marijuana dispensary owner Stuart Carter says the numerous investors knocking at his door are all based in the U.S.
Michigan's in a unique situation right now, and there are, you know, $200 to $300 million in investment money looking to find homes in Michigan.
Carter says he is turning down investors, preferring to put his own money in the Utopia Gardens dispensary. Yet he says licensed dispensaries in Michigan do face a big problem, a shortage of marijuana. The state used to allow caregivers for medical marijuana patients to sell any excess pot to dispensaries. But Carter says the state now mandates that dispensaries buy only from licensed marijuana growers. And he says they have not grown enough pot yet to supply dispensaries.
The state had to extend a deadline that allowed the dispensaries to buy from caregivers because there was literally no product available for us to sell.
By the start of next year, caregivers will be required to sell their product only to growers, who will then sell it to dispensaries, until the growers can produce enough pot of their own to sell. Carter says that could take 6 months or more, with roughly 36 licensed dispensaries in Michigan taking a big financial hit. He says growers are asking more than double the price caregivers used to charge, with no real end in sight.
The growers will not have product. There will probably, by June of next year, be 3 times as many dispensaries as today. So how are they going to have the productivity to supply 100? It's a ridiculous middleman gouge.
Carter estimates there's also about 100 unlicensed dispensaries which can buy their pot on the black market if necessary and take customers away from the shops that are following the state's rules. With marijuana legal in both Canada and Michigan now, there's likely no shortage of pot on the street. Carter says Canadians in the cannabis business potentially being banned from crossing the border will not affect his dispensary. But even so, marijuana remains criminalized under U.S. federal law, and Carter says he takes no chances at a customs toll booth.
I don't even take my business card because I'm not interested in being scrutinized by the Border Patrol.
With Michigan's cannabis industry still flowering, those involved in it don't want to burn any future bridges, especially those that cross the border. I'm Quinn Kleinfelter.
We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, some of our more memorable stories from 2018. A Northern Michigan town's mission to get childhood literacy back on track. Learn why a little dent in your car could cost you a lot more these days. And from being an immigrant to being the center of the Flint water crisis, we'll talk with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha about her new memoir. You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director at WKAR News. In this segment, we are sharing some of our more memorable stories from 2018. In April, we launched a weekly series of reports focused on education in Michigan, specifically efforts to get childhood literacy back on track in our state. WKAR education reporter Kevin Lavery took us to northern Michigan, to a town that is on the rebound when it comes to raising better readers.
Everyone loves a tale of redemption. The 2016 Cubs, the 2018 Loyola men's basketball team. Of course, comeback stories don't just happen in sports or in Chicago. This one takes place on our side of the lake, at an elementary school in a northern Michigan tourist town. You might call this one the Kenwood comeback. You can describe Cadillac, Michigan in just 2 words, woods and water. Towering pines nestle the shores of 2 large lakes. Come Memorial Day weekend, Cadillac will come alive with fishers, boaters, and hikers. The very picture of a summertime dream. Cadillac. glam rock band Kiss once played here at the high school's 1975 homecoming. There's a monument to the moment near the school. And just down the road sits Kenwood Elementary. 4 years ago, Kelly Buckmaster heard the words no principal ever wants to hear. The state called Kenwood a priority school after its overall performance ranked in just the second percentile of all schools in the state.
It's alarming. No one wants to be working at the bottom performing school in Michigan.
The students were stressed out. Many had disciplinary issues. Kenwood had a reputation in the community. And that's when Emily Bender arrived. She's the school counselor.
It was like, oh, good luck at Kenwood, and you're going to have your hands full at Kenwood. So right away, I had a soft spot in my heart for, you know, the kids here and the staff here, and I could see that they wanted what was best.
What Kenwood needed was resources. Wexford County is one of the poorest counties in Michigan. The average household income here is just over $40,000 a year, and about 70% of Kenwood students qualify for free and reduced lunch. Bender noticed Kenwood was the only one of Cadillac's four elementary schools without a mentoring program. So she reached out to some local churches who donated clothes, money, and some quality one-on-one time. One even built the kids some new playground equipment. Meanwhile, the teachers recommitted to strong academic results. They developed small group instruction tailored to individual students. They created checkpoints along the way. And, says Principal Kelly Buckmaster, they built classrooms focused on their students' achievements rather than their own agendas.
A teacher-centered classroom is one where the teacher is making their plans and they're covering curriculum, and they feel as though that's what the job is. And when you have a student-centered classroom, you assess, you know, did they get what I wanted them to learn? Did they learn it? And if they didn't, what do I do about it then?
Who can tell me what a verb is? Addie?
Something you do.
Something you do, an action word. Nice job, guys.
Kenwood made strong strides in reading and math. Within 2 years, the school had climbed from the number 2 percentile to 59th. Today, Kenwood students far outpace the state average for students in poverty. The problems haven't gone away completely, though. Counselor Emily Bender says one of the biggest issues is attendance.
There's a lot of misconceptions about kids are like cutting and pasting all day, and who cares if they miss school one day a week? We know the reality of that is they're doing really important academic things. So a kid that's missing one day of school a week or even a couple days a month, that's really impactful in the long run when you look at all the instruction they're missing.
Troy Finstrom is part of the Kenwood recipe. He started off 4 years ago as a classroom teacher. His job title now, success worker.
What's a success worker?
It's an everything job.
Finstrom works with behaviorally challenged kids. He's a sort of Sherpa on their journey through life's lessons, like perseverance and accepting failure.
A lot of times kids come in and they're always told, oh, you're the best, you're the greatest, oh, you're awesome, you're this. And they don't ever hear like, yeah, you know, we didn't do our best on this one. We need to try a little harder, or yep, we weren't picked first. That's life. How do you accept it? How do you realize it's not an attack on me? It's not somebody putting me down. And just developing resilience.
Finstrom can see the changes in behavior. There was a time, he says, when discipline problems prevented Kenwood from holding all school assemblies. Now they happen every Friday.
To me, that's the biggest telltale overall sign of our turnaround, is that we can have our kids together celebrating, acknowledging each other, and really focusing more on what we can do instead of what we can't.
Kenwood Elementary is still a work in progress, but some of the techniques tried here are starting to catch on in a few other schools in the district. With its numbers back in the black, the question is, can Cadillac take its brand on the road to rev up the engines of schools all across the state of Michigan? For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Speaking of reading, you may have noticed something new on the sidewalk when you walk around parts of Lansing. Back in September, Jamie Paisley was there as the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry Project launched.
Imagine you're heading to grab a bite in Old Town Lansing, or taking a game at Cooley Law School Stadium, but there's this stuff on the ground that catches your eye. It's not chalk or anything, it's words. engraved in the pavement itself. This is the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry Project. Here's one of the organizers, Rulaine Stokes, president of the Lansing Poetry Club, at the opening gala, which was held at the Lansing Art Gallery in downtown.
It's a grant from the City of Lansing through the Lansing Economic Development Corporation and the Arts Council of Greater Lansing to elicit poems about place, about people's connection to specifically four neighborhoods in Lansing: Old Town, Rio Town, the Stadium District, and the East Side. We got 76 submissions, and then we had a panel of judges who worked to try and narrow it down to 8 poems. And then we had our winners, and then the whole process of engraving the poems in the sidewalk. So it's been a 9-month process.
Even before this official launch of the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry Project, Lansing Mayor Andy Shore had a poetry run-in while out with a City Hall colleague.
We took the Grab and Go, the new shuttle, up to Old Town and had lunch. And there it was on the sidewalk. It was really exciting. You know, you talk about it and you hear about it and then you see it right there on the street. So it was awesome. It's an important part of who we are in Lansing. We are artistic. We are cultural. We love to share about ourselves. And now you can walk down the street and see poetry right on the street. It's part of the atmosphere.
Another of the organizers of the Sidewalk Poetry Project is Lansing's inaugural poet laureate, Dennis Heinrichsen. Now, Heinrichsen didn't know how this project would go, either in terms of entries that came in or where across Lansing the poetry would physically go.
No, it was, there was no way to actually identify the spots prior to identifying the winners, because this is about place. So the poem determined the place. So once we had the 8 winners, I got my tape measure and I drove around town looking for clean concrete and tried to match the poem with place so that it resonated. So when you look at a poem about the Shiawassee Street Bridge, you are looking at the bridge. When you're reading a poem about Old Town and its Hispanic heritage and the Brinke Fish Ladder, you are standing on the Brinke Fish Ladder.
And the poet whose work is now on permanent display at the Brinke Fish Ladder in Old Town Lansing is Cruz Villarreal. The engraving of his poem, Mi Pueblo, was something he definitely wasn't going to miss when the time came.
Dennis calls me up and says, "Hey, dude, they're putting in your poem." And so I, you know, slam on the brakes, turn around, head to the ladder. And oh my God, that's when it all, you know, like, wow, this is really happening. They're actually putting my poem in the concrete. I'm in stone, dude.
And it was simple as for why Old Town is important to Villarreal.
Any community action that's taken place in Lansing was born there. It was where Latinos congregated. It's where anything, any kind of activism or any issue that needed to be resolved was born in Old Town, Northside, right? That's why the poem has that. That's why it's in Spanish and English. It's a marriage. That Latino heritage there, that history there, now I feel like it's not going to go away.
We've placed a map of the 8 locations to the Lansing Sidewalk Poetry online at WKAR.org. In Lansing, Jamie Paisley, WKAR News.
Thank you for listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. The cost of repairing body damage after an auto accident is going up. New technology can make even a minor fender bender very expensive. WKAR's Scott Pohl explains.
Safety is becoming a big focus for car companies. And as new safety features roll out, they're showing up in advertisements like this one for Toyota's Intelligent Clearance Sonar.
This new feature is designed to provide automatic braking if crossing traffic is detected while reversing out of a driveway or parking spot.
Sounds great, but what if your new car with this technology gets rear-ended? The repair bill just shot up. AAA has looked into how repairs are getting more expensive. Their research has yielded some startling results. Replacing parking assistance sensors can increase a repair bill by $1,300. And those rear radar sensors could make a repair bill more than $2,000 more expensive when compared to repairing similar damage on a car without them. AAA spokesperson Nancy Kane has another example of these higher repair costs, the sensors built into some side mirrors.
You know, in the old days, you had a side mirror. And if you happened to get too close to a mailbox or your garage door and you banged into it, it just wouldn't cost that much to fix it. But now with the sensor, it'll be more than $1,100 more just to repair that side mirror.
Want more evidence? How about windshields? Kane says 14 million windshields are replaced in the United States every year. She explains that if you get a chip in the glass in front of front camera sensors, things can get complicated.
When it's higher up and it's affecting the camera, you really got to get that replaced. And that's why the price can go way up, way up. Replacing a windshield on a vehicle equipped with a camera behind that glass can cost easily $1,500 more.
Here's another spot where sensors are showing up, inside the emblem on the front of the vehicle. Eric Phelps is an estimator at Vision Collision in Lansing.
So where usually an emblem would cost, you know, $30, and it costs a little bit of time to put it on, I wrote one last week for about $500, just for an emblem. Having to replace those even for a light scratch or something like that will more than like, you know, if it's on the line, it'll probably total out the vehicle a lot quicker.
Phelps adds that many of these new sensors can only be calibrated at a dealership. That means moving a car back and forth from the body shop to a nearby dealer. You might think some insurers would try to avoid these more costly repairs, but Phelps isn't seeing that.
They'll go above and beyond pretty much just to make sure the customer's safe. They don't want to skimp out on like sending a car on down to the body shop or down to the mechanic shop just to make sure the sensors are okay, just save some a little bit of money. Now, where on down the road, if that ends up being faulty, they'll be liable for it.
Nancy Kane of AAA says Michigan's already high auto insurance rates could be made even higher by these expensive bills, and she encourages new car buyers to look into what the insurance costs will be before choosing a vehicle. While repairs are potentially more expensive, you might find discounts based on equipment that will make it less likely you'll get into an accident.
These new advances that we've got, these new traffic safety systems that are being added more and more to the vehicles, we're totally in favor of them. They're wonderful. They save lives. They prevent injuries. We just want motorists to be aware, you know, of the price it costs to repair these more expensive items.
Advanced safety technology is becoming standard on some vehicles, so this trend of higher repair costs is likely to continue. For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
The Lansing School District has a high percentage of students who meet the federal poverty threshold. During the school year, thousands qualify for federal free and reduced lunches. We wanted to know how these students get enough to eat during the summer. WKAR's Kevin Lavery reports on one program that tries to fill that need.
On a hot summer day, a bus winds its way down Baker Street. This isn't the mustard yellow carriage that appears every day to chauffeur the neighborhood kids to that place that most have already blissfully forgotten. This bus is emblazoned with appetizing artistry. Colorfully painted fruits and vegetables catch the eye and water the mouth. The driver pulls into Baker Denora Park. A few kids are playing kickball. Others are seated under a shady pavilion. One young man looks ready to get down to business.
Who's this young guy?
Can you say your name?
Evan John Hayduke.
And how old are you, Evan?
5.
This looks like a great place to play in the park in the summertime.
Yeah.
What do you like to play out here?
The slides when the food bus comes.
What do you like about the food bus?
Because they have different foods.
The bus is operated by the YMCA of Lansing. It's part of the Lansing School District's Meet Up and Eat Up program. The food is supplied by Sodexo Magic, a contractor led by Lansing favorite son, Irvin Magic Johnson.
I got it.
From June till August, children can get free meals at some 60 sites in the Lansing area. Most are in community centers, churches, and libraries. A few, like Baker Denora, are served by bus. There's two parts to these mobile visits. Before the bus even arrives, YMCA staffers come ahead to lead the kids in outdoor games like the kickball match.
Do you want to play soccer with us?
Then comes the meal. Tara Barnhill is the mobile kitchen coordinator for the YMCA. She says even though the program mainly serves Lansing students, adults are welcome too.
So as long as you're with us during the 30 minutes of activity, you can get involved, and then the 20 minutes of feeding, anybody can eat with us. We serve adults as well, as long as they're with children. You guys ready? All right, come on up. You can get your breakfast and your milk, all right?
Barnhill lines the kids up for breakfast. Today's options include banana bread, a muffin, or a cereal bar, plus juice and milk. Young Evan comes back to the pavilion to eat with his mom, Allison Brooks. She smiles as he eagerly drinks his milk. They've been coming here for a couple of summers now.
It helps the kids in the neighborhood get meals during the week when they sometimes can't get that. It's very important. Not everybody can afford nutritious food, so having this available to the kids for free is amazing.
This is the fifth year for the YMCA's Healthy Living Mobile Kitchen, as the bus is known. Over time, Barnhill and her staff have gotten to know many of the neighborhood kids. Some even work with them during the year as physical education instructors in the Lansing schools. Kathy Krimer recently moved from San Diego to be closer to her extended family, including her great-grandson. He's here today along with one of his friends. Krimer cuts a matronly figure whose care reaches deep into the neighborhood.
Sometimes I come here with four or five different little kids in the neighborhood that I've picked up, and I do worry about their food security. Now, mine may not have that as much as some of the others, but it's a good little extra for him because he's always been on the thin side. So he's getting a little extra and learning how to eat with other kids, which he hasn't had.
Tara Barnhill recognizes her Goodwill mission, which today includes a quick behind-the-scenes tour of the food bus.
Is this what your school bus looks like?
No.
What I really love to see is when they see a fruit or vegetable they've never even seen before and I can get them to try it and they actually end up liking it. So I'd say success is just seeing the same faces every day and the kids getting excited to see us and having fun.
Breakfast is over. Time to move on to the next stop. But the bus will be back on Baker Street in a few hours for lunch. Chicken tacos with garbanzo beans. That just might be a new one for the kids to try, and a fun little vocabulary word to help ward off the summer slide. In Lansing, Kevin Lavery, WKAR News.
Thank you for listening to Current State from WKAR. For many businesses, hitting 1 year can be a big milestone. WKAR's Jamie Paisley sat down with one man celebrating four decades in East Lansing.
Roy Saper has been bringing art to East Lansing for 40 years. It began when he was in his 20s, running a new business out of his home in downtown East Lansing on Bailey Street, back in 1978. But even though many art galleries fold quickly, Roy's grew and eventually needed a change of venue.
In 1985 is when I bought this land. Interestingly, it was owned by Butterfield Theaters, who owned in downtown East Lansing the campus and the state theaters. They owned this land, vacant parcel in downtown East Lansing in the corner of Elbert and Division, so that nobody would build a movie theater here. So I drove to Southfield, I believe it was, and met with the owners of Butterfield Theaters, and they quoted me a price for this land that was three times the price I paid for my Bailey Street home. And I said yes. And so I came back to the lot after I bought this, and the weeds were growing across the sidewalk, and there were posts around the perimeter of the land, perimeter of the property. There were dead trees on the lot. But I went from there with this imagination of a contemporary-looking, really clean, really nice building with a lot of light.
Though the newly relocated Saper Galleries did have a weakness, an outdoor sculpture garden which left some items vulnerable to purloining.
It was crazy. I'd come in the morning, I'm looking out the window into our courtyard and thinking, wait, hey, where's that 7-foot-tall sculpture that weighs hundreds of pounds? And that's when I realized, I spent more than $250,000 to enclose that courtyard and expand it, make it a little bit larger. And I'm glad I did, because it brings with the lighting that we have, brings the outdoors in, so you almost feel like you're outdoors. There are plants. It's a beautiful location, and it's a beautiful venue for viewing art.
After his youth in Flint, Michigan, Saper came to MSU in East Lansing, where he eventually began studying computer science, a burgeoning field in the late 60s and early 70s. But his love for art collecting shone through, and Saper was an early adopter of digital pricing algorithms and cataloging, a key to Roy Saper of his 40 years in business.
We're the first gallery, I think, anywhere which used the computers in the ways that we still do and most galleries now do. Now we know every day what countries have visitors on our website and what they're looking at. Technology is the only way a business today can survive, no matter what business it is. And we're proud to always be on the cutting edge of that. And that's observed by those who find Saper galleries, even though they might not be able to place Michigan on a map.
Because of its location just north of MSU, there is a lot of student foot traffic, and they may have never have visited a gallery before and have that deer in headlights look just walking into the building.
I'll tell you what it is. There's this sense of awe and discovery when they come in. They look around, and the first comment is, I had no idea this place was so large in size. It's deceiving from the outside. You see a little door and you see a brick wall. Well, it's when you come in, it is large. And when an 18 or 20 year old comes in, oftentimes they look around, they rush out, and then about 5 minutes later, they come back with two or three friends. That's a sign of success as far as I'm concerned.
Bit by bit, putting it together.
Last week, Saper Galleries and founder Roy Saper celebrated 40 years in business. You can swing by and check out the hundreds of works of art in their East Lansing building, found on the northwest corner of Albert and Division. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Pediatrician, professor, public health advocate.
I thought it would have been easy to write just a Flint book, a Flint water crisis book. But I took a risk, and I wanted to include my immigrant story into this book because no matter how I tried when I was writing the story, I couldn't separate the two.
Coming up, we talk with Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha about her new memoir and what it reveals about the Flint water crisis and herself. Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, returns after this. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director at WKAR News. Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, a pediatrician at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint, uncovered the extent of the problems caused by lead in the city's water supply. It's become one of the most serious environmental challenges in recent memory. Now she's written a book about the crisis. What the Eyes Don't See recounts her life story, the discovery of lead in the water, and the aftermath of the disaster. In September, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha talked with WKAR's Scott Pohl.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl. Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, a pediatrician at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint, uncovered the extent of the problems caused by lead in the city's water supply. It's become one of the most serious environmental challenges in recent memory. Now she's written a book about the crisis. What the Eyes Don't See recounts her life story, the discovery of lead in the water, and the aftermath of the disaster. I talked with Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha this week about writing the book.
Yeah, so I started writing this book over 2 years ago, and I knew even back then that we would need a way to shine a spotlight back on Flint. I knew the nation's attention would fade, completely understandably, but I knew that our issues were long-term, and I wanted people to recognize that Flint is still there.
Is there a particular meaning to the title you've chosen, What the Eyes Don't See?
Absolutely. So it means many things, and I encourage the readers to kind of dig deep and find out what their meanings are. But it's about It's about the very literal. So we do not see lead in water. We also do not see the consequences of lead right away. But ultimately, it's about people and places and problems that we choose not to see that are taking place all over, and we ignore these things. And then it's about our ability and our power, the power within really all of us, to open our eyes and to see these things and to take action and to make a difference in our communities.
Your dedication for the book is to the children of Flint. Can you explain choosing that dedication?
The kids of Flint are my inspiration. They are what wake me up every day. They are the ones that give me hope. They are brave, and they are bright, and they are smart, and they are resilient. And it is the children of Flint that I owe this story to, and it's a privilege to be able to share this story about them. But it is a privilege to be a physician who is able to care for them.
One might wonder then that since you have dedicated the book to the children of Flint, if you're sharing the profits from book sales with the children of Flint in some fashion.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the reasons I wrote this book. So a portion of the proceeds go to our Flint Kids Fund. So shortly after the crisis, we created the Flint Child Health and Development Fund at the Community Foundation of Greater Flint, flintkids.org. So this writing this book is a mechanism to give back to that fund, but also to go out and speak. And every one of my speaking events, it provides more information about that fund.
Would you mind reading a passage of the book for us?
Sure. This is the story of the most important and emblematic environmental and public health disaster of this young century. More bluntly, it is a story of a government poisoning its own citizens and then lying about it. It is a story about what happens when the very people responsible for keeping us safe care more about money and power than they care about us or our children. But there is another story, another side of Flint, because it is also a story about how we came together and fought back, and how each of us, no matter who we are, a parent, an activist, a school teacher, a pediatrician, has within us a piece of the answer. We each have the power to fix things. We can open one another's eyes to problems.
Thank you for reading that for us. A big part of your book that I think some people might be surprised by, hopefully pleasantly surprised by, is how big a portion of the story is your own personal immigrant story. Can you explain how your story fits in with the water crisis in Flint?
Absolutely. So this is not just a Flint book. This is a memoir, and that means there's a lot of me in this book. I thought it would have been easy to write just a Flint book, a Flint water crisis book, but I took a risk, and I wanted to include my immigrant story into this book, because no matter how I tried when I was writing the story, I couldn't separate the two. I'm a first-generation Iraqi immigrant. We came to this country fleeing a dictatorship. We came to this country for freedom and opportunity and democracy. And I wake up every day fortunate and grateful to be in this country, but also very much knowing what injustice is like and could be like. It is with that lens that I see the world, and that has framed my career choice, that has framed the work that I do, and that ultimately framed my response to this crisis.
I'd like to ask you about what was probably a difficult period of time when you knew something was going on and that it was related to the quality of the water in Flint, and yet you didn't feel comfortable with the notion of going public with what you were finding amongst the children you treat. Can you tell me about that period where you thought something was going on, maybe even knew something was going on, but couldn't really go public or tell patients? What was that like?
Sure. So for so long, I was reassuring my patients, telling them everything was fine because I was being reassured by government. So moms would come and say, is it okay for me to mix my baby's formula with this tap water? And I would say, of course it's okay. It's America. It's the 21st century. There's laws and regulations, and we're in the middle of the Great Lakes. Of course it's okay. They say there's bacteria, but it's being treated. Everything seems to be okay. Not until I heard about the possibility of lead in the water did I start to realize that it's not okay. And when I realized that, every patient I saw was told to take precautions. But there was a period before getting kind of that hard evidence where I wanted to scream from the rooftops and alert people that there was a problem. But I couldn't yet because I didn't have that data. And my the number of data was too small, and I had to get a bigger sample size. So there was a period of waiting. And that was hard because I wanted to tell everybody that there was concerns. And that's ultimately why we had a press conference. In academics, in medicine, you don't share research at a press conference. You publish. You present your work in research conferences. But that takes a long time. So we did take a shortcut by sharing this before I had gone through that peer review process because our children did not have another data spare.
Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha has written a book about the Flint water crisis. It's called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Dr. Mona, when I heard about your book, I expected it to get lots of coverage from the news media here in Michigan, but it's gone far beyond that. Coverage on the CBS Sunday Morning Show, you've been on the Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. The Flint story continues to get national attention. That's a good thing, I'm sure you think, not just in terms of book sales and promotion, but that people continue to know that there is a problem that hasn't yet completely been solved in Flint.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely why I decided to write this book, so that people would pay attention to Flint again. We are doing amazing things in Flint, and I want people to know that, yeah, not only do we have this, ongoing issues with water and the access and affordability of water, but I wanted people to know about the awesome things that we are doing in Flint. So this story very much is about that hope, and I want other cities to learn from us. Yeah, we had this crisis, but we have rolled up our sleeves in the city, and we have invested in children. We have things like brand new child care centers and literacy expansion and home visiting programs and Medicaid expansion, nutrition prescriptions and mobile grocery stores. It is a place of creativity and innovation. And that's also what we want to share.
I'd like to ask you about your recent flow of patient traffic at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint, the extent to which children continue to suffer from the ill effects of being exposed to lead. If things are getting any better amongst the patients you see, how would you describe things?
Sure. So that's also part of the title of this book, What the Eyes Don't See. So you do not acutely see the consequences of lead exposure. Lead is known as a silent pediatric epidemic. You see the consequences maybe years and maybe decades later. And people ask me that all the time. How are people doing? How are the Flint kids doing? And we are working hard to objectively answer that in a population level way. We have recently launched the Flint Registry, flintregistry.org. This is our way to find out how the people of Flint are doing, their health and their development, ongoing lead exposure, get them connected to the resources to limit any consequences, and then follow up with them. This registry is modeled after other large-scale registries like the World Trade Center Registry, but we're taking it a step further. Those registries were created by and large to just see how people are doing, to see the consequences of a disaster. We are doing this to not see the consequences of a disaster. So this is a service registry so that in 5, 10, 15 years, we can tell you, yeah, this happened, but we were able to do this, this, and this, and this for this person, and this is how they're doing.
I've heard you say that even though the state of Michigan considers the water in Flint to be safe now and distribution of bottled water has ended, you won't drink the tap water yourself. Can you explain why? And tell me what you're advising patients about drinking the water or using it for other purposes.
So I will not drink the tap water in Flint, nor will I drink it anywhere else. So this process has taught me a lot about water quality in our nation. And I have learned that the federal laws, the rules on the book, specifically the lead and copper rule, are weak. We were never meant to have lead-free water in this nation because of those laws. Michigan has taken a brave step forward recently and has drafted a lead and copper rule that actually exceeds federal standards. That's awesome. But we have more to do nationally to strengthen these regulations, specifically that lead and copper rule. The action level is too high. It has not caught up with the science that we now know of, that there is no safe level of lead.
The governor and state lawmakers are talking about requiring every lead service line in Michigan to be replaced over a certain period
yep.
of time.
That's awesome.
What can you tell me about that and how you think that might play out?
That is exactly the direction we need to be going. That is a way that we are learning from this crisis. There is lead in all of our plumbing. We were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead in our plumbing. Those service lines, which are the lines that go from your water main to your home, weren't restricted until 1986. But there was actually lead that was allowable in brass fixtures until 2014. Lead is a problem, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest in our plumbing. We've known about it for decades, about lead in our plumbing. Flint was not the first time we've had a lead and water disaster. There was a even worse one in Washington, D.C. over a decade ago. We need to learn from these disasters. We need to invest in our infrastructure to make sure that our children are ultimately protected, because now, unlike those other times, there's been amazing science about lead toxicity. And we know that even very low levels can impact children's cognition and behavior and their entire life course trajectory.
Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha's new book about the Flint water crisis is called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Thank you again for talking with WKAR. Great talking with you.
It's great to be with you.
This is Scott Pohl.
Only months ago, musicians, politicians, friends, and family remembered the legendary Aretha Franklin. The 76-year-old passed away in Detroit from pancreatic cancer, silencing a music career that lasted more than a half century. On the day before her funeral, I spent hours in Detroit with people who poured out love for the Queen of Soul. On Thursday, Linwood Street may have been the busiest street in Detroit.
Baby, baby, sweet baby.
Aretha Franklin's voice blasted from boomboxes.
$10 t-shirts.
Vendors sold t-shirts with images of the songstress. On this hot August day, generators hooked up to fans helped cool down a mile-long line of people slowly making their way to the New Bethel Baptist Church. The last public viewing of Franklin was in the same pulpit where she sang publicly for the first time at 9 years old.
We drove in from Bronx, New York.
Lalar Hayes says her mother sang with Franklin at a Virginia church. She holds up a t-shirt showing the Queen of Soul behind the wheel of a pink Cadillac and the letters R-E-S-P-E-C-T above.
This is what that lady brought to us, respect, because we as women, that's what we need. You have a lot of people who don't respect us, but she made them to respect us. And I love her, and I'm going to miss her.
We actually flew, so it was a short trip, but it's been great.
Joyce and John Herzig flew in from Ohio for their final farewell.
I've always followed her. I just, you know, loved her music, and so we want to come over and help celebrate her life.
She just inspired everybody. She was just a great lady.
Zakiya Nixon, like Franklin, grew up in Detroit.
Oh my gosh, she means everything powerful, everything womanhood, everything that's strong. We were raised on her music, so that was our cleanup music.
As the line begins filing into the church, Reverend Jesse Jackson, one of the speakers at Friday's funeral service, arrives. He tells reporters of Aretha Franklin holding an 11-city concert tour to raise money for Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement.
Well, a sense of sacrifice and risk and service is the meaning to me as I sing it.
Minutes later, Gloria Lay of Highland Park leaves the church. She's almost giddy describing Franklin's clothing for this viewing.
She looked like she had on a long, gold, sparkling outfit and the shoes and from head to toe, and her hair was just out of sight. She was absolutely gorgeous.
A few miles away from the crowds on Linwood Street, there's quiet reflection inside the Detroit Windsor Dance Academy.
But it's a big, nice picture. These are so old.
Artistic director Deborah White Hunt shows me photos of Aretha Franklin surrounded by her dancers.
Our relationship goes back to the 80s when we first choreographed for her. She had auditions at our studio. She talked to me about things that she felt, you know, she wanted to see in her dancers.
This music is from a concert in 2013. Franklin is dressed in white, performing on one side of the stage, while dancers from the academy twirl, stretch, and soar next to her. Deborah White Hunt said tapping local talent was important to Franklin.
And just giving us the opportunity to share our gifts through her gifts. It's like artistry met artistry, and she appreciated that. And I'll never forget that, ever.
Dancer Amber Nahimana Aponi performed on stage with Franklin in 2014.
Me, I just saw the humanity in her because she was an artist from Detroit. You could just sense that right away. You could just sense that this is where she was from. It was like home to her. So anyone who was around her probably felt very comfortable because of that. She was very down to earth.
From a dance studio in New Center.
I would thank her for all that she did for all of us. And for what she did for dance and what she did for Detroit.
To Streetside, outside of the New Bethel Baptist Church.
The people that come out for Miss Franklin, it's an honor to be a part of history making for our queen.
You can feel it citywide. Appreciation for Aretha Franklin, her music, and her love for the Motor City. With that, we will say thank you for tuning in to this incredible year of news here on Current State from WKAR News. Our reporting team consists of Abigail Sinsky, Emily Fox, Kevin Lavery, Al Martin, Laura Michaels, Jamie Paisley, Scott Pohl, Shayna Roth, and Carell Vega. Our interns are Amanda Barbarina, Honda Carter, Joe Dandrin, Tatiana Hemphill, and McKenna Ross. Drew Henderson is WKAR's chief radio engineer. WKAR's station manager is Peter Worf. WKAR's director of broadcasting is Susie Elkins. WKAR is part of the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences at Michigan State University. I'm Reginald Hardwick, digital news director at WKAR News. Thank you for listening and supporting WKAR Public Media. We'll connect with you again in 2019.